Hey everyone, I just wanted to take a minute to talk about the Eufy Video Lock. It's a smart lock that's really easy to set up with just a Phillips screwdriver and no extra drilling. It's got a keyless entry, so you don't need to worry about fumbling with the keys when your hands are full. Also, you don't need to worry about handing out extra keys when you're in a pinch, your kids losing them, or people copying the key and passing it around to each other. Something else I like about the Eufy Video Lock is that it has a camera built in and it works as a doorbell as well. Personally, I think the Eufy Video Lock is great for apartments or cottages where you can't necessarily add extra holes for a video doorbell. My favorite part about it, though, is that there isn't a monthly fee and your recordings are locally stored, so you don't have to worry about someone else owning your doorbell data. You can find it on Amazon, or if you want to know more, search Eufy Video Lock, that's E-U-F-Y Video Lock, or visit eufyofficial.com/videolock to see how you can gain complete control of your door.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And welcome to the Home Assistant Podcast. My name's Phil. Joining me as usual, I've got Rohan. Hey, Rohan, how's it going?
Hey, good. How are you?
Good. And today we've got Ian with us. Hey, Ian.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
This episode of the Home Assistant Podcast is sponsored by Home Assistant Cloud by Nabucasa. Easily access your local Home Assistant instance remotely for a small monthly fee that supports the Home Assistant and the ESP Home projects. Configuration is done via the user interface, so no fiddling with router settings, SSL certificates, or any YAML. Ian, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. Whereabouts are you from, and give us a little bit of an intro to who you are.
Yeah, so I'm on the East Coast in the US, in Connecticut. So if the New England fall leaves are just about over at this point. Nice. Getting nice and cold over here.
Yeah.
In my day job, I do cybersecurity right now. Started getting into that, especially after the pandemic, found myself mm-hmm. going from normal IT into cybersecurity. And before that was manufacturing engineering and control systems management. So our home assistant is a nice little hobby that meshes with work.
Nice. Yeah, isn't it? It works out nicely, right? Like when you can look at home and go, oh yeah, I can see how that applies to work, or, oh, I've just done something at work. That would be really cool to do at home in home assistant, right? Like, I like it. So what got you into, or where did you start with home automation?
Yeah. So really for me, it started about 5 years ago, 2018. We just moved to a new city and had a newborn at the time. And I found out that with my new job, I was going to be actually traveling a considerable amount. They wanted me to live out of a hotel for at least 4 months. So my wife was pretty concerned about safety. She was going to be home with the new child all the time. And so it was, how do we get, she wanted a normal like alarm system or just a security system. And I had concerns about, like, I don't want some other vendor, some third party knowing, am I home or not? Right. Like it never sat well with me. And so, especially when you have like ADT, one of the big companies here, they have call centers in India, and it's like, I don't know what's happening with that data. I don't know if they're selling it to some other party that's going to go rob my house when I'm gone. Like, I just, you know, it never sat well with me. So I did tons of research just trying to figure out, had anybody else out there ever designed their own home security system? And that's kind of how I landed in the home assistant world, was, oh, people have not only done that, but they've taken it to the next level. You know, 5 years ago, it was not as user-friendly as it was today with Home Assistant, right? So mm-hmm. I had a basic IT background, but not a developer mm-hmm. by any means. And so I ended up having to learn a lot, like just learning YAML. And that was still very prevalent back then, right? And got into it that way. But it ended up being like the best thing for me because it forced me to learn all these skills that ultimately was a launch pad for me into a whole new career. And it was like my whole career path that I'm on now is ultimately because of Home Assistant, learning how to use YAML, JSON, things like that. But then also showing the power of hosting something locally, but also tying it to the cloud. Like you get the best of both worlds.
Sure. That's a really cool. Yeah. So as you started going through that, what were kind of some of the, you came from technology, but you didn't have a programming background and stuff like that. What were like a couple of the big things that you've, you know, find kind of difficult to get started with because of that? Was it like, cause YAML, I don't know. I found YAML fairly okay to learn. Like it wasn't like strenuous to learn it or anything like that. I don't know if that was your experience as well. And then how did you evolve from there?
Yeah. So the biggest thing with YAML was, it didn't seem like there were any beginner's guides. Like I'm like looking through the owner's manual kind of a thing. And I learned by reading the manual. So for most programming languages, I can figure them out through that. But YAML just, it was a lot of blog hunting and it was a lot of, you know, hey, people seeing how other people did it and almost reverse engineering it. In the last year, thanks to the large language models, that's completely changed, right? So, what does this do with YAML? How do I build it in YAML? That it's so much easier now because I have a chat, you know, Bing chat, like will explain all the YAML to me. And so had I done that, had that large language model been available in 2018 when I first started, I think it would have been an even easier experience for me.
Sure. But
I had to do it the hard way of reverse engineering logs.
Yeah,
I've just started using like GitHub Copilot, and it's amazing, right? Like I can't believe just some of the stuff, like even just like obscure APIs, and you can just, you know, talk to it and say, all right, I'm trying to do this in this API, what is the right, like what am I doing? Like, oh yeah, you should be using this one, right?
It's even been great for the like schematics. So I found like you can take a picture of a schematic, so if somebody's like, hey, I did this really cool thing with a ESP32, and you take the schematic and you don't know what exactly it does or why it works, rather than now having to go back and look through what does every chip do, read the manuals, all that, you can actually upload the picture and it will tell you what it does. And then I found that what's really cool too is if you take it from, okay, this was a print for an ESP32, but you want to ship that over to a Raspberry Pi, like the new Pi Zeros or Pi Ws. If you can actually have the AI convert it over to you and it will give you a new pinout diagram based on what was done with the ESP32. And so things like that accelerate this whole process of learning. I mean, that's ultimately what it is for me, is I get to learn all of these new things, and having that, that copilot there just accelerates it, makes it even more enjoyable.
I do. I do wonder if there's ever going to be a, you know, put a pin in the wrong place and, you know, all of a sudden you get a fried ESP board or something. Because I've certainly had, you know, the API say to me, oh, yeah, you can do this in the code, and then you run the code and it doesn't do that.
It doesn't work.
Yeah, no, that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
That option on that function doesn't exist, mate. What are you giving me? All right.
Yeah. GPT, I find GPT is hit or miss, right? Sometimes, well, with 3.5, especially, with like ChatGPT 3.5, it's pretty, I find it's like, it's accurate, but when it's like programming stuff, it's kind of more missed than it is a hit. 4 has gotten a lot better with that though, but because you can even be like, hey, like for example, like Ian, along the lines of what you were saying, like I was trying to figure out schematics, I'd be like, hey, here's a data sheet for something and tell me how this works, right? And it'll be like, okay, boom 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 boom, right? And it's like, what are some considerations I need to take when I'm building this? And like it'll be like, okay, don't forget this and this and this, right? Like, so it's kind of cool, but
So for me, when I was learning all this the hard way back in 2018, before a modern large language model, that even though it's not perfect, right, it's still a huge help for us. Like, I love the Copilot type branding because it's like, okay, I'm still in control, but I've got somebody helping me. Or the way I think about it is it's like 1,000 high school interns at your disposal. they're they might not be perfect, but a high schooler is still pretty smart and they can go do something to help you out. And if you have 1,000 of them just going to help you out, like if, as long as you go into it with that understanding that you don't expect it to be perfect, it's very powerful. But yeah, in 2018, just trying to figure this stuff out from scratch, I was taking a lot of my manufacturing mentality to it. So it was a lot of like, go deploy these sensors, go figure out what I have in my home and observe behavior. So just deploying the sensors first was the huge thing. And then because I was coming from manufacturing, control bands was how I thought. And so it was, what's normal in the house? What is normal behavior? And does it stay inside that control band? And that's what I started with most of my automations on, was just saying, is everything expected and normal? And then I also, because of manufacturing discipline, assumed failure. So I assume that everything is going to fail at some point. So I built in a lot of redundancy. And so I brought a lot of these things naturally to what I started playing with Home Assistant to do. And then in 2019, I attended a conference and found out that there were like industry names for these mindsets of zero trust and chaos engineering. And so ever since then, I've just been able to run with that.
Use the buzzword.
Use the buzzword.
That's right. Yep. That's funny. So what were some of the first things that you kind of automated, like in terms of, like, I know you said security was your first primary use case, right? So what did that include?
Yeah, so at first it was door sensors, locks, motion sensors, and then eventually got to cameras and things like that. But I started, so just being able to see when does the door open and shut? How does that relate to a motion sensor? Seeing all of those sensors, was ultimately able to start getting ahead of what would normally be human behavior. So I could say, hey, my phone just came in to the house. Rather than saying automatically unlock the door, I assume that it's not me holding my phone. So, but I start using that as a trigger and say, my phone just came to the house and it knows it's my phone. So now I can say the doorbell camera should be looking for my face, not any face, but start looking just for my face. And if it sees my face and, you know, say like a 90% probability of it's me, then it unlocks the door automatically. And so you get to this, like the zero trust principles of no standing privilege. So like, I don't have a standing privilege to my own home. The key does not work. Right. If you use a key to my front door, it actually alarms. It's treated like a break glass account, like you would do in enterprise IT. But I end up with a better use case or a better user experience, even though I have no standing privilege, because my door automatically opens for me. So I could have hands full of groceries, kids, whatever. Yeah. And I just walk up to my door and it's unlocked. And then as soon as I close it, it locks behind me. But that was only possible because I was able to see what are those normal behaviors that what does right look like, and then look for that. And anything other than that is assumed to be a compromise, because you turn it into a statistical model and you say, here's what my tails look like. Those will never happen. Here's what right looks like in the middle. And you automate for that. And it's just gone from there.
That's cool. So when you're thinking about designing, or you know, when you wanted to get those door sensors, did you have, all right, I'm going out at this, I don't trust anyone or don't trust any third party. So are you looking for only local devices, I'm guessing, you know, no Wi-Fi sensors for those door sensors? You know, did you choose Zigbee, Z-Wave? Was that on your mind?
Yeah, absolutely. So I actually avoided Wi-Fi for the longest time. I went with both Z-Wave and the Zigbee. And because I assume failure of systems, I actually use a lot of everything, all the protocols is what I try to do too. So I try to, as much as I really like the Z-Wave stuff a lot, and especially with the changes that have happened over the last year or two, it's gotten so much better. But I still try to make sure I'm not overly dependent on one of those protocols. So in the event that my Z-Wave radio fails, I want to make sure that my whole home didn't fail, right? So only parts of it can fail at a time, as long as I'm using multiple protocols. And I've really liked the Matter stuff lately, and Thread, actually. So I have HomeKit devices, even though I'm not an Apple person by any means, I have HomeKit devices now, because it just plugs in, and it's truly a vendor agnostic platform that gives you that resiliency. But it also means, because of going with that local security mindset, like, and just trying to keep it off of Wi-Fi means somebody has to physically be there to penetrate me versus the remote access. And it takes a load off of my firewalls and traffic routing and things like that. But it's been pretty reasonable. You know, I really haven't had any failures. That's another nice thing. Even though I planned for all of this, everything's been really resilient, and I'm sticking with the Raspberry Pi 4 still because it works.
Interesting. Yeah. And so for someone to walk up to your door, like you had that example before of, you know, I walk up to my door, I've got groceries in my hand, the camera recognizes my face. Are you using a Frigate or a Coral, you know, processor to do the facial recognition, or are you allowing, you know, like an Amazon hosted instance somewhere to do that recognition for you and then bring it back in locally?
Yeah, so I've integrated this with my Azure tenant. So I use the Azure Face API for the face part. Because actually where I be in the cybersecurity side of it, I have all the M365 Sentinel, all those security things there for my hardware. And so I've actually been able to take that telemetry and tie it to Home Assistant as well. So if my entire family's M365 telemetry is outside of the area, even if my phone says I'm in the area, there's a mismatch, right? And so I don't have automations on that other than an alert that says what my cloud telemetry is telling me through Microsoft licensing is actually divergent from what my home is seeing. And that in itself is an anomaly. And so I can start to feed that actually up to my Sentinel instance, and Sentinel will start looking at it as I have an anomaly. Is this related to an actual attack, or is it why? Right. And we start getting to that. Why do I have this thing? But it's that zero trust principle of I'm assuming everything's failing. I'm assuming everything's a breach. And every time that there's a mismatch, I alert that and I go investigate. And very rarely is it a system failure, or if it is a system failure, I can go redesign it, build it better, add new sensors, et cetera.
So when you get those alerts to say, all right, there's an anomaly here, what happens if, like, you're walking up to the door, right, and family's out and there's an anomaly? Does the door just not open and then you've got to manually punch in a code, or how does that work?
Yeah. So if I don't meet the threshold for, essentially, it's like I'm creating my own risk score, right? So like the same thing that you would have on your computer of, you know, are you allowed this permission with your enterprise IT stuff? I'm essentially creating a risk score. So if it can't get that score based on telemetry, or if there's enough anomalies there, then the next thing is my PIN has to go. But my PIN doesn't always stay on the door. It only stays on the door if certain conditions are met as well, right? So if I'm clearly out of town, I could give you my PIN, right? Like, and it wouldn't work because there's no need for my PIN to be entered, right? So there's those kinds of things that happen as well. And I go through multiple failure points of, okay, the cloud is down. Yep. What happens if it fails over to a PIN? What if the PIN is not working for whatever reason? I've got other break glass kind of things. In the event that I use it, you know, it's open the mailbox 3 times, turn around and do a dance, various kinds of, you know, secret processes to do a break glass turn on, essentially. Yeah. Like I even have a failover for another Raspberry Pi that if the Pi fails, it'll fail over. So I don't have my Zigbee and Z-Wave because I don't have the radios, but I have my break glass account still there. But then it does send... I've got multiple things too. It'll send the alert through Home Assistant to my phone that says a break glass account was just done. Sends it to my wife's phone. We also have a family Teams meeting, like account set up. Yep. So it'll send a Teams message as well. And a couple other things that I have in there where, again, it goes through multiple vectors. Some of them are cloud-based. Some of them are local. Some of them rely on Home Assistant. Some of them do not. But I want to make sure that the message gets out, especially if a break glass account was used, which should never, ever be used. I want to make sure that message gets out.
Right.
Now, so this is like fascinating for me. So how often do you think, or how often does it actually happen? Like where you walk up to the door, like I'm going to keep running with that door open scenario. out of, you know, 9 times out of 10, would you say that the door unlocks for you and it doesn't detect an anomaly? Like, how solid is it now for you that it's, you know, not an annoyance to have to use a different thing every time?
Yeah. So I have not used my PIN in years at this point. Like, that's kind of the beauty of it. Because the telemetry that you get through the Home Assistant app for your phone is pretty solid. And so, you know, it's not like your GPS just randomly fluctuates around the world. Like, right, you're getting an accurate GPS signal. And then you combine that with, okay, is my phone on the Wi-Fi? And you combine that with Bluetooth presence detection. And in order for it to actually fail, you would have had to have, you know, your phone itself would have had to fail, or those sensors really have not failed on me. And that's been the nice part. And as long as Home Assistant is collecting that data and processing it properly, which again has been rock solid in the last few years. You know, 5 years ago, I don't know if I could have gotten quite to this accuracy, but the Home Assistant's been solid. That, yeah, I can truly depend on it. Now, I still assume failure, right? Like, I still have that in the back of my mind, like something will fail. But, and I exercise that every once in a while, like turn Bluetooth off on my phone, see if it still works.
Yeah.
But it's more importantly, like, all of this stuff has made it to where my wife is a believer. Like, that's probably the most important thing on here. And I've heard other guests say that too. She's a believer in the Home Assistant thing now. Like, just even when I took it down for a week, she's like, where did everything go? I need all my Home Assistant stuff. And it's wife approved, which means it's actually resilient. It's not just a toy anymore for me.
Right.
Yeah. That was okay. It's going to be my next question. Like, how, like, often does it fail for your wife compared to you? Like, is it always, like, is it solid enough that you don't have to act as IT support all the time? Or
so the only thing that's failed every once in a while is my Zigbee radio. Every once in a while it just will turn off, and so it'll be like, okay, can't change the thermostat in the middle of the night. Or got an automation for one of our kids now where if you turn the TV on, one of the lights turns on as well, so you can see at night, like when you're, it's almost like a night light, because he's use the TV as the nightlight, which actually just triggers another light to turn on. And when that fails, it's frustrating, and she actually has to go manually turn off the light. And so but again, that's a pattern I can detect. So every time that I get called as IT support, I dig into it. And so what I've ended up doing is, I don't know the root cause of some of these failures, especially with the Zigbee radio. But I end up just doing a weekly reboot. So I automatically do a full reboot of Home Assistant 2 a.m. on Sundays or whatever time. And now I don't have any issues. So I have never figured that one out, but it's at this point, doing that full reboot, automated full reboot, seems to have solved everything.
If it comes up in the morning. That's my only concern.
Didn't you have something like that, Phil? Where you had to reboot everything?
Yeah. That's long. Yeah, I would have had that ages ago. I don't have to do that anymore. I probably should, just to clear out the cobwebs. Like, my Home Assistant log file is massive every time I upgrade every month. But yeah, I probably should.
Yeah, interesting.
So one of the nice things, though, that, and why, you know, I truly say I owe my current career to Home Assistant. Everything that I learned with this stuff in 2018, 2019. Just that little thing of showing I have a more secure home, but also a better user experience. That was blasphemy in the cybersecurity world pre-COVID. Because the assumption was every time you add security, you hurt the user experience, right? It's another layer. It's another pain point for the user. And so just a simple model I was able to show with my home of, I have tremendous security that I have full control and I have anomaly detection, but because I have that telemetry, I'm able to use it for a better user experience. I was able to show that to my boss at the time, you know, when COVID hit, and I was like, this zero trust thing is actually a good thing. Like, it's real. It's not, it is a buzzword, but it's actually real. Like, if you do it right, and security and usability are no longer inverse. You can use zero trust methodologies to actually give a better user experience by taking that zero trust telemetry and automating things to make the user experience better. And so by Home Assistant Lab became like the model for the COVID restructuring of enterprise IT in 2020. And so all of these policy automations that I would build with Home Assistant, it became a question of, okay, now how do I do this at the enterprise scale? And so what's surprising is there's a direct correlation between how you write an automation in Home Assistant and how you write like a conditional access policy with M365, or how you write a playbook in Sentinel, which is just where I end up putting a lot of my time with enterprise stuff. And so it was like, okay, how do I take an endpoint telemetry with the user identity telemetry and all these things and combine them together? Well, that's what I was doing at home to unlock my front door for, as one example, right? And now it's, we'll take that same idea. I'm using different tools at scale. I can't use a Home Assistant on a Raspberry Pi for 500,000 users, but I can use, you know, other enterprise tools, but the automation is fundamentally the same and the mindset's the same. And so we're able to take this and create brand new environment post-COVID for 500,000 users that was far better than everything they had before. And the user experience is better. The security is incredibly better. The telemetry to find bad guys was so much more in depth. And it was truly taking that zero trust mindset, but it all happened because of Home Assistant, like, and being able to have Home Assistant as my lab. Like, Home Assistant is truly my enterprise lab. And that's what's crazy is things that I do for global customers now. It's, if I haven't proved it on Home Assistant first, as a mentality, as a mindset, I don't take it to a customer. And it's been just extremely successful.
That's cool. So from an automation perspective and stuff like that, so outside of the security use case that you talked about, what kind of stuff do you do? Like, I mean, do you do any light stuff or like TVs or like what's involved there?
Yeah. So kind of everything that I can get telemetry on is what I suck up first and foremost, right? You know, can like sensor up before I even start the automations. So yeah, I've got my TVs connected in there. I love, actually, one of the best things that they did was, you know, you can tell what's cloud dependent, what's not now, like just at a visual. That has been one of the best things because I plug everything in there, pull in forecast, pull in solar telemetry, pull in everything that I can, but being able to see what's native from my house and what am I pulling from somewhere else. But even simple stuff like our toothbrushes, right? The Oral-B integration and say, okay, I know when my teeth are being brushed. I haven't done much with that automation or with that telemetry yet, but as my kids get older, I guarantee you, I will have something in there that says, nope, you did not brush your teeth twice today because you didn't do a Home Assistant. Therefore you don't get TV. But so, you know, there's some things of having that telemetry is valuable, but I've done like the light switches, played with a lot of the things that I love is just playing with a bunch of different brands and seeing what I like. So I've had various IKEA stuff. I don't use the IKEA bridge. I just plug it straight into the Zigbee bridge, right? To see, okay, how's the IKEA devices versus all these other crazy brands out there. I've done some Shellys. I've done, just trying to look through my dashboard now. I have like a little bit of everything, right? And just partially to learn, but partially just to see what works, what doesn't. And this,
sure,
what makes it really hard is it all works. So I haven't been able to pick favorite because it actually all works. So I end up learning a lot out of it. The one thing though, that kind of going to the original thing for me with the home security, when I started doing the light switches, I realized early on too, that if the light switch itself can actually become a sensor. So if we're gone and the house is armed, if somebody turns a light on, that's an indication of breach, right? Like they might've bypassed my door sensors, my window sensors, all that stuff. But if they, as soon as they turn on a light, that's an anomaly. And so those were the other things that I was able to do is what is taking that from what's normal behavior and try to make it easier for the human, have the lights turn on automatically when you wake up, things like that. But there's the counterpart. There's always that security side of it is What telemetry can I use to say something just isn't right? Whether that's a bad guy or, you know, a pump failure, like my, I have my sump pump monitored with the power usage. And that's actually been one of my favorites is use the power usage with the sump pump and the fact that you can do the differential equation with it now and that of the statistics. Because the pump goes at various times based on how much it's rained outside and all these weather factors, right?
Sure. So
I don't know how often the pump should run, but I do know that it should have a certain slope at a certain time of power consumption. And if it ever drops to zero over a 12-hour period, it never kicked on and I know I have a pump failure. And so it's never happened yet, but I sleep better at night knowing that I have this automation there that if my sump pump fails for whatever reason and isn't turning on ever, I actually get an alert on that before I've flooded basement. So
nice.
You know, it's a lot of proactive things like that too.
That's cool. Yeah. Like that's actually really neat where you start actually making sure things are actually working and stuff like that, right? You have those checks kind of built into Home Assistant for itself. So that is really cool. How about any voice things?
I haven't done any voice things yet. I haven't had time to quite play with that. I do have like the Wyoming stuff installed on here and some of the local text to speech. But I haven't done that's like on my wish list is to do the actual custom wake word and all that stuff. Just haven't quite had time to play with it yet. But actually to that point, it's created some seeing it work here again on a Raspberry Pi 4. Like I intentionally, at one point I had a much bigger PC that I was using for Home Assistant and I intentionally went back to the 4 more for my day job because I was able to say, hey, if I have this running on a Raspberry Pi 4, why the heck can't we get stuff running with our enterprise grade technology on the edge?
Sure.
You know, we've got the cloud, let's push it to the edge. And so seeing like the Wyoming protocol out there working beautifully on a 4, it's given us some inspiration for how do we take other AI-based things and push them to the edge for other customers, right? I spent time playing on submarines back in the day and, you know, you don't have that connectivity to the cloud. The cloud just doesn't work with submarines. And so I've always had this inherent desire to make things work at the edge because that's how life was like on a submarine.
Sure.
But now it's just, I use it as a forcing function, right? Like if an open source group like Home Assistant can make AI work at the edge on a Raspberry Pi 4, there is no reason why industry keeps failing. So it's kind of good soapbox to stand on.
No, I'm right there with you, man. It's, I think it's one of those things where it's also kind of cool, right? Where, you know, you see things like, to your point, things like an open source project like Home Assistant being like, hey, you know what? We're actually going to start pushing industry to start doing cooler things, right? Because you have a lot of the people that are like, no, it can't be done. Well, it's like, well, it kind of can, right? Like it's, so it's just pushing the envelope a little bit, right? Obviously, there might be different things when it comes to, you know, your home versus an enterprise grade something or the other, but conceptually, it's possible, right? So.
Yeah, that's actually one of the things that's been fun too is there's actually like a employee club for Home Assistant at my work now. So it's the what is everybody doing for Home Assistant, and then it easily translates to why aren't we doing this? Why aren't we doing this as a company? How could we integrate this? And so it's the culture. That is one thing that I will say. The culture of the Home Assistant community has been great. Like even just the documentation and. Like I used the documentation in my last job to say, here's the standard, right? I'm using an open source community driven effort as a standard for documentation because our documentation standard wasn't that good. And so I've used Home Assistant so much for public shaming to the corporate world. it's just great. Yeah. And it's almost like I wish I could give back more. And I keep seeing everybody say, oh yeah, just subscribe to the Nabucasa. And, okay, well, I have 2 subscriptions to that. I need to do more, though. I need to give back more. I feel like there's something more that, you know, we need to buy 1,000 coffees for the core team or something.
it's funny. I see it on Facebook all the time, right? Where people are like, hey, you know, like I'm trying to, you know, get away from subscriptions and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, and then you'll see like some other people that are like, hey, you know, the only one I give to is Nabucasa because, you know, there's like, I find value in what they do and like that kind of thing. Right. And, it's, I don't know. It's, I think it's kind of cool. I don't know. I do it. I have a sub.
Yeah.
Like Phil does too. And, but, oh man, cool.
So when you say you've got like all this telemetry going from your house or you've got the telemetry in your house, are you doing like, is everything in your house like powered by YAML? Like, is this all being calculated locally in home? This isn't in YAML, or are you offshooting all the states somewhere else and then calculating, all right, yes, this is an anomaly here. Don't do that automation now. Like, how is all that data like being processed?
Yeah. So I'm doing everything through Home Assistant first and foremost, because I want kind of going into that chaos engineering mindset of, I assume the internet will fail. I want to be able to do most, if not all, functions locally if the internet goes out. We've got tons of trees here. Like, we do have internet outages constantly. Like, behind a Starlink is the next thing on my list for that added resiliency. But so I want everything to be local, but there's also a lot of telemetry I have in the cloud based on living a normal life away from home. But so I want to kind of be able to do that correlation. And so I end up doing I think they rebranded it now, but it was like the Azure IoT Hub. You can actually pass the telemetry through there. So I create a copy of all my telemetry and push it up to the cloud. And then I'm able to overlay that on top of, other telemetry I have, like sign-in logs for Azure AD and like all of those other things, and start to play with the data. It's also how I've been able to learn some of these more powerful cloud type analytics as well. It's easier to learn when it's your own telemetry that you know what's going on. So if I'm trying to say, hey, I want to learn Kusto query language with Sentinel, for example, I learned that by asking it, how many times has my door opened today? I know how many times my door is open because I have it in Home Assistant. I know what that telemetry looks like. But now that I've pushed that telemetry up to the cloud, I can learn how to write that query. And so it's been a lot of how I've learned these other enterprise things, because I take my home telemetry and push it up there. And there are a few things where I do have a like Sentinel creating and triggering something that'll actually happen on Home Assistant. So that's where the webhooks come in handy and say, I can have Sentinel push something. If my Defender stance in the cloud, so my EDR and all that stuff with my Microsoft Defender telemetry, if I see that activity there and I have a certain risk score, certain alert that happens, I actually have so there's an automation in Sentinel that uses the webhook that tells Home Assistant that there's likely adversarial activity happening, which then triggers my DNS to take a different posture. So I end up in this place where the cloud actually is telling my home to harden its posture through my DNS to say, go to this new profile because we think that there might be a possible attack on you or your family in your cyber estate. And so that's where I've been playing with it a lot more is, you know, a lot of people with Home Assistant, they're anti-cloud. And there's a lot of reason for that of, sure. I mean, just looking at the garage door fund lately, right? So I think it's dependency on SaaS providers that are unpredictable, but there's a lot of power in the cloud, especially when you start looking at IaaS and the ability to custom do stuff. I like using the power of the cloud with the home, but I don't assume the cloud will be there. I assume it will be failed. I assume the cloud will disappear. And as long as you go in with that mindset, I think you end up with a very resilient infrastructure that you get the best of both worlds. I get everything local, but there's a lot of processing I can do in the cloud that I can't do on-prem. Even if I had $5 million stack, right? I can't reproduce the power of Azure. So I still try to do stuff up there. So just see what happens, you know?
I think the anti-cloud piece is also around like services, right? Not like it's also like, hey, this thing that I bought has a reliance on cloud. I think it's a little different when you're building your own thing in the cloud too, right? Like, again, whatever service that might be. And not to say that, you know, tomorrow Microsoft won't sunset Defender or you know, whatever that is, right? But at least there's some reliance on that provider. But depending on who that provider is and what they are, there could be a level of trust, right? Whereas, you know, you have Chamberlain for MyQ, for example, or that whole MyQ system, and or Logitech, right? That just starts saying, hey, you know what? We're going to start bricking devices, or we're going to start doing whatever, right? So I think there's a little bit of a difference there, right? When you build your own services, just not in your house, right? And slight piece there, but.
Yeah, and I think that's what Home Assistant's done a really good job of, is showing.
Yeah.
It's you can be vendor neutral, right? Because it's you're looking at the protocol, you're not looking at the actual vendor in most cases. And now, like with the little cloud thing, it's like you've got that warning as a consumer. So, I mean, this has honestly changed because of Home Assistant. It's completely changed the way I purchase things for the home, right? It's as a last resort, will I buy something that is a proprietary cloud first protocol? And it's so, like, the only thing in my house, for example, is my hot water heater with Rheem. It goes up to the cloud, and it's cloud native. I can't get locally. But that was a conscious decision of, okay, of all the hot water heater things out there, none of them have a local thing. What am I actually going to use this telemetry for? But fine, I give up. I will do it with that. But other things, like I just did a whole geothermal thing for home heating here.
Cool.
Based on Home Assistant telemetry. So that was actually the other thing that I wanted to point out here, is because I have all this telemetry, and when I make decisions about upgrades to the home, I can do it in a much more data-driven way. So like we just did this geothermal thing where we got off of oil heat and now we're electric geothermal. I know it will pay for itself in under 6 years, because I had all this telemetry beforehand. I knew every day how much oil I was using. I knew all of my behavior of heat, outside temperature, able to calculate all that. And now that we've got this new system, I know exactly what it's going to pay for itself, and I have control. But in determining what vendor to go with for an HVAC unit, it was this other element. And I was working with so many different installers to say, some of them wanted just to throw an Ecobee thermostat there. And I said, no, I refuse, right? I need a different option that I can do locally. And luckily found one where they could, it's not local by default, but the great people of the Home Assistant world out there figured out a reverse proxy to actually hijack it and say, hey, we've got a local instance. And so I'm a happy consumer, or I'm not dependent on this, but it was such a huge factor. I was willing to spend more money on a system that I could feed into Home Assistant than one that was cloud native with just an Ecobee thermostat.
Yep. That's cool. So from a geothermal perspective, what made you go that way? Just out of curiosity.
Yeah. So, was looking at, all the different ways that I could heat and cool the home. And oil here in New England is just prevalent, and it's expensive. And especially in the last couple of years, it just keeps getting worse and worse. There is no financial goodness in sight. So looked at like a normal heat pump that, goes out to the air, right? It's like your air conditioner in reverse. But at a certain point, it just doesn't work because it gets so cold sometimes, right? I think, Rod, you've got that same situation being where you are.
Yeah.
And so the geothermal was this nice thing where they dug two giant wells into the ground. And so instead of dumping the heat or taking the heat from the air and putting it in the house, it's doing it from the earth, because the earth is a constant 55 degrees Fahrenheit. So that heat was just, it's always there. So we've only had it for about a week and a half now. So I'm still very new, but I have enough telemetry because of Home Assistant. I know based on outside temperature, based on all the different factors, we already have a 40% savings in electricity versus oil daily usage. And that's how I was able to get I will be right around the 6-year payback mark, all from a week and a half worth of telemetry. And I'm pretty sure that's accurate. Cause again, I've got 20 different temperature sensors around the house. I have outdoor temperature sensors. Yep. I knew exactly how much electricity I was consuming, how much oil I was consuming before, and just able to calculate that stuff to make, you know, it's essentially a business decision at home. It's great for the earth, great for the family. But it was all done because I had that telemetry. And that's like the important part here is I can now make data-driven decisions about the home that I could never do before. And again, take that to an industry and enterprise and say, if you don't have all these sensors in your business, how the heck are you making accurate financial decisions about what you're buying, what you want to build as infrastructure? Like, I don't build anything for my house now unless I have the telemetry saying it's either a good or bad thing, or it's even, you know, a reason to spend my money on it.
And where are you storing all this telemetry long term? Like, if you've got Grafana running somewhere, or if you've got another instance in Azure running up, storing it up there?
Yeah. So I've been trying to play with that a little bit too. I don't have a solid long-term storage thing figured out yet. That was one of the reasons I initially upgraded to a larger PC. I wanted longer term storage. And then, what I end up doing now is I store those things that are what I think is relevant now, kind of goes up to my, it's an ADX cluster up in the cloud. It was an Azure Data Analytics, just a big blob storage container, essentially.
Yep.
Right.
But I've been trying to figure out what's the right way. Like, I kind of want to store everything, but I don't use everything. So actually that was like my biggest thing. I just could not figure out. So, I mean, I would say luckily the Home Assistant team saved me again, with the introduction of the statistics, right? Like, some of these things that I wanted long-term storage for, I was doing it just for statistical calculations. Once that became native, I really didn't have a need for long-term storage natively anymore.
Interesting. Okay.
And as a cybersecurity person, do you want that data long-term, right? Like, do you want the light switches in the bathroom being known for like the next 5 years somewhere? Like, you know, at 2 a.m. 5 years ago, you turn your light switch on, you know, twice a night, and now you only do it once a night. Like, do you need someone to be able to potentially find that data out about you?
Well, yeah, that's the interesting part, is like, how much is too much? See, there's another element to that though, Phil, like, license plate readers. So, you know, you get a camera and it's like, okay, I want every car that's ever been in my driveway. Some of those things I want to know, like, okay, if my house does get broken into, I want to know over the last 24 hours, what license plates were there. And so that's kind of in the enterprise thing, again, like, that's the SOC mentality. That's the, I've got a bad guy in my network. Yeah. I need to get them out right away.
Yeah.
But there's this other element of the deeper intelligence stuff that still comes into play, where the long-term storage you'd want. So we want to be able to ask questions like, okay, have I ever seen this license plate? Has this license plate ever been at my house over the last 10 years? Right. Like, you want to be able to see that, because then you start getting to these other questions of, wow, my house was being cased by the same car for the last 5 years. So there almost is a need for some of that long-term storage, but it's not hot storage that you need, right? So like, it's cold storage. Want it there in the event that I ever want to ask a big question. But that's kind of where the large language model stuff is coming into play too. And like, various co-pilots. As a human, I'm not going to go figure out those crazy connections that are five layers deep. But now with these large language models, like, especially if I can plug it into my own private data and say, hey, what is the trigger for this thing? I see it through the history graph, but maybe there's something before that I'm missing. Like, that's where I think it's going to get cool. And that's partially where I want to keep the data. I don't know what tech is going to be there the next few years where that data could be useful.
Yeah. Well, take something like that and point it at this data and be like, what's happening, right? Like, figure this piece out, right? It's there's some cool things there. Yeah, I completely agree with you.
Yeah. I mean, it's the tech is just moving so fast. It gets crazy. But the only thing, actually, speaking of log data and like what you were saying, Phil, is like, do you really want somebody looking at that? The only thing out of everything that the Home Assistant team has been doing, I only have one thing on my wish list. And it kind of goes to that data security thing. So I want to be able to say, like, I have time-based accounts or role-based accounts, right? So okay, I have accounts for people that visit, babysitter, in-laws, et cetera. And they only work once they're actually at the home on the Wi-Fi, and then the account gets turned on and they're only able to see certain dashboards, right? But what I can't restrict, as far as I'm aware, is they can still see the log data. They can still see history. They can still see everything else of the other users. So I wish there was a way that I could say users only see dashboards instead of still seeing some of those other things on the side. So there is an RBAC function of Home Assistant, but it's only for the dashboards. It's not for actually protecting the data. And there are some things like, I don't want my guests to know what is my current phone state. I don't want my guests to know some of that data, right? And so that's been the only hesitation there of really going forward with access to others that come to the house and giving them their account, because they still can look through the log data if they chose to.
That's a good thought, actually. I'm sure there's ways you can like hack around that. So either A, build that same kind of dashboard outside of the Home Assistant, but or do like there's a ton of like CSS mods and stuff like that you can do. Like I've seen a lot of people do for tablets and stuff like that too, right? Or user interfaces that are public. So you can do things like that to just not even just show those options. But that's not to say that they can't just go to like whatever, homeassistant.local/blah blah 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 blah, right? Like you can't figure out that too. Yeah. To your point, like that kind of a user should just not have access to that. I think that's an interesting facet right there. Yeah.
Yeah, especially because I played with the idea of, okay, well, what if I just have the tablet on the wall, you know, that's in full screen mode all the time and there's the dashboard. But then because of, I mean, going back to the front door access, I need them to be able to say, okay, where they are with their phone when they go for a walk, if they leave the house, they need to be able to come back in and take that telemetry that proves that they are who they are, where they are. Because I want to be able to see through the Home Assistant app, for example, like I want to be able to see that telemetry that it's not just some random phone on my Wi-Fi with their credentials. I actually want to see the GPS coordinates as well before they get access to the house. And so, but then, the downside of that is I can't force them into full screen mode all the time on their phone. Right. So that's the trade-off right now. I haven't figured out a way on that, but that's my only wish list is, take the RBAC that exists in Home Assistant and just put it to all those other functions on the the left-hand side. And then, you know, all the security concerns would be mitigated at that point, I think, too.
I even look at it as a see live data versus historical data, right? Like maybe I do want you to see the current state of the door, but I don't need you to see the state of the door 2 minutes ago. Right.
Yeah.
I'm thinking that's a babysitter or something like that, right? Yeah.
If I want you to see the state of the door, I would put that in a dashboard. If I didn't want, you know, right? So, but the fact that people can just go look through the logbook right now and see the raw data of everything and changes of state, that's the concern. Especially if you're saying, I've got a babysitter and, okay, babysitter, here you've got Home Assistant, here's control to the things in the house I want you to control. I don't necessarily want them to see the other stuff, right? It's like, I want to be able to control. It's the zero trust type thing again, right? Of like, I want just in time, just enough access based on who you are, where you are, what you are kind of thing.
Yeah. No, I think it's interesting. Agree with that. And I mean,
it's interesting that you would even consider giving like someone like a guest or a babysitter a Home Assistant account. Like my philosophy always is that you shouldn't need to touch Home Assistant. The house should just do its thing, right? Like, so yeah. But in your scenario, it sounds like you need an Home Assistant account to get have enough data to verify that, you know, that's them coming up to the front door and, you know, they're on their phones on the network, so they're actually home. It's, yeah, it's a
Yeah. I agree with that. Like for the house to operate, the house operates without the interaction. But there's other things because of the fact that I can plug all of these other things into Home Assistant. It's a way for me to say, okay, here's access to the TV shows that the kids want, the music, the other things that's not just the house itself. So instead of having to say, okay, here's my Disney Plus password and here's all this other stuff, I can say, here, I made a Home Assistant account for you. This is everything that you might need to control in the house at any time. And, you know, oh, here's an SOS button as well. Like hit the SOS button and I have, it pings us. It says, hey, the babysitter needs us, whatever. Like those are the kinds of things that why being able to give it on their phone is such a nice way to do it. Because it's a way to communicate those essentially based on their role. Right. And that babysitter profile is very different than what my in-laws might see. If they're watching the kids, they might get more access. Right. But because I can plug in all of my other accounts into this and truly be that vendor neutral one-stop shop, that makes it so powerful for everything and other users. And the fact that I can say, okay, as soon as that person leaves the house, their account is disabled. Like I don't have to worry about them coming and manipulating stuff. I can say, and that's actually where the calendar function was so nice too. Because I can say, hey, so-and-so is scheduled to be at the house during this time. If they're on the Wi-Fi during the scheduled time, enable their account and they can come on in. If they show up to the house unannounced, they're not going to get their account enabled because they're not on the calendar, right? So it's all of those things coming together.
Now do it in reverse. I'm the babysitter and you want me to install an app that has a location 24 hours a day pushed up to the cloud. Would you feel comfortable if someone said that to you though? Like it seems.
Well, so that's kind of the thing of the account disablement, right? And it doesn't even have to be the app, right? You could just do the web browser thing and say local access only. But that's the thing is that you could actually have that, that granular discussion and say, there's telemetry I want on some people, telemetry I don't want on others. So the babysitter probably don't necessarily need the GPS coordinates on them. But I could still give them an account and say, here's access to the entire music library and video library and everything else. Have at it, but I don't want them to have access to that all the time either. And I'm only pulling the telemetry of when they're actually open in the app. Right. So and that's again, the beauty of this zero trust mindset is you get just enough based on those credentials. If you can't prove who you are, where you are to a certain degree, this would be like a managed endpoint in the corporate world, right? If you're not a truly managed, fully defended endpoint, well, maybe I don't let you download data. I only get you a view of the data, not the actual download of the data. And so bringing that mentality to Home Assistant saying, if I don't know exactly who you are, or where you are, but you have an account, okay, maybe there are certain things you can't do at the house until you actually prove that you're physically there with GPS signal in addition to other signal.
Makes sense. So what's your future plans for the house? Like what are you, we had Year of the Voice this year. What are you hoping next year is going to be your big next addition for you personally?
Oh man, that is a great question. I mean, honestly, I just need time to catch up with the Year of the Voice. So I need time to catch up with all the stuff. Yep. But I mean, I think it would be cool. I mean, I'm already seeing this in the chats and, you know, just the community in general, like people really playing with large language models. I think the fact that these new models are coming out that allow you to keep to be private, right, where you can take the model and overlay it on your own data, I think there's going to be a use for that Home Assistant because you can say, like, what I want to be able to ask, like, what if you could ask questions of my house in natural 100%. Language and have it do those 100%. Analytics?
Yep.
And the, you know, when the large language models first came out, there was no way you would do that. But now that the private data capabilities are there, like, you know, like you mentioned the co-pilot type thing, a lot of those co-pilot things are keeping your data private. Yeah. Being able to push that to the home, that I think that's just like the next step of especially if we already have voice. Now, if you can use that voice to interact through a natural language with your home in that extra degree. I think that would be cool, but I definitely don't have time to play with it myself right now because I haven't even built my little voice triggers.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's my wish list. Absolutely. I just love this platform. It's great. It's wherever it goes, I will gladly follow it.
I hear you. Yeah. You know what? I'll leave you with this for what it's worth. The voice piece is actually fairly simple. I've been playing with it for a little bit. And you know, even generating your own wake word and stuff like that. It's honestly, it's not difficult. I think I figured it out in probably about less than an hour for sure. And that includes, I mean, some of the time it takes is actually to go in and train that data to say like whatever your wake word is to go generate that wake word and stuff like that. If you choose to use your own, but than that, it's once you get the services up and running behind the scenes, which because I'm running it in Docker, I have to run them individually. But again, the Nabucasa piece actually makes that easier too, right? Because when you have that subscription, you can subscribe to their cloud-based ones. But I wanted it, for me, I wanted to test both local and cloud-based. So the cloud-based one just worked. The local one, I just had to make sure I had those Docker services running and stuff like that. And honestly, it's pretty cool when you see it working. You're like, okay, that's neat, right? And I mean, you're kind of used to it because I mean, I have Amazon Echoes all around my house, and I've got a couple of Google Homes spattered around wherever, but I think it's a little different when it's actually running on your stuff, right? Because it's one of those things where I was like, oh, this is neat, because it's actually like I'm not sending this, like Amazon isn't making the decision to say, hey, go talk to Home Assistant to go turn it on and blah blah blah. You are directly talking to Home Assistant, which is pretty neat. So
yeah
that's definitely cool. I've done, you know, again, like the out of the box stuff with Wyoming and like just that is great. Like just hold the button down on my Android and it goes, but having the whole house being able to listen would be pretty cool. Or even just I love seeing the old school telephones. Like I want to go over to Goodwill and see if they got the phone, pick it up and be like, I want to talk to my house. And then, if you did that with a large language model too. So that's actually one thing so I've done this separate, and if I could get it in a Home Assistant, it would be even better. Like have the kids say, like that, what they want a good night story to be about. And like, oh, I want it to be about a purple unicorn.
Yep.
Whatever. And then you get it tells a bedtime story. So right now I'm manually doing that I take that that's generated by Bing Chat, ChatGPT type stuff. And then I copy it into Home Assistant, copy the text that it generates for a good night story. And I copy that into Home Assistant to then have it do the play over the speakers. And so if I had the large language model plugged in, then I could actually just pick up the phone to Home Assistant and say, hey, I want a good night story for a 5-year-old about blank, you know, and then have it play in that room. Because right now it's just, I have to manually copy and paste it. But, you know, that's still like one of the great things about Home Assistant is the fact that I can put text in there and then it will do the text to speech for me. For even a long bedtime story could play through the speakers is pretty fun.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing I mentioned, like just saving money with energy. But ultimately, because the way Home Assistant works, I'm able to save money on so many other things that when you compare it to the rest of society, you have products that are purpose built and with little effort, I'm able to emulate that with Home Assistant for a fraction of the price. So I'm thinking of just how do my kids interact with this? One of those things that we did for the same one who was a newbornish in 2018, right now she's 5. And it was like, hey, how do we let her know it's okay to wake up? Like it's time to get up and go do stuff. And they make these lights that do that. And you can program it with your phone and Bluetooth and all that are, I don't know how much they are. But to me, it was expensive. And I was like, I can do that same thing with Home Assistant, right? So get the color changing light bulb with Zigbee and create a little automation that says, hey, change the light to this color at this time. And so for about $10, I was able to do what is a, you know, it required a easily $100 thing to do with a different product. And then I retained that privacy because I didn't need to get an account with this other vendor that has to link to my phone to say, oh, here's the schedule for my kid, right? So that, you know, and then that $90 savings I had, I now can feed right back into Home Assistant for more stuff. And so it's an element of, you know, it's just so many wins that being able to use Home Assistant as that central policy enforcement point, like from a zero trust standpoint, it's the sky's the limit, and you can end up doing things so much cheaper because of it. Like, yeah, I don't need the Ecobee Nest thermostats that are super expensive because I use the dumb thermostat and I control it all with Home Assistant, right? It gets, it's just tremendous cost savings because of that. And I think that's almost overrated too. Like, and I just see how everybody else who is not using Home Assistant lives. They're buying all these products that have a markup because there's overhead, and I can completely bypass all of that and provide a better experience again for my family, better user experience. So it's just a great platform overall.
Yeah.
Even the last thing is color changing light, right? It's like you get the wish list from the kids, like the Partysaurus Rex. I don't know if you guys seen that with, you know, kids on Disney Plus. They have this little short with Partysaurus Rex in the bathtub and the lights are strobe lights flashing and all that.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that'd be cool. Well, okay, that's super easy. Let's create a little automation in Home Assistant that makes the lights change and flash. Take all the color changing lights from the house, put them all in the bathroom, and now we have a strobe light Partysaurus Rex bathtub time for the kids, just like just like they saw on TV. And it's like, yeah, it took all of 30 seconds of programming effort, and I just created this awesome thing for the kids that would otherwise have been impossible, right? So it's little things like that really,
yeah,
it makes it personable. It started out as a security system. It started out as a thing for me to learn IT and all this, but now it's a way to actually engage deeper with the family because of the ability to do all this stuff. And so that's kind of where, just for me, it's come full circle of it's just really cool. Anyway, talk all day about how amazing Home Assistant is.
Yeah, I hear you.
That's cool. Well, awesome. Ian, thank you so much. Really appreciate talking to us today. It's interesting to see like a different perspective in terms of someone with a cybersecurity mindset coming in, how you secure the home. Really cool talking to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. It was great talking to you and getting to meet you. It's great, you know, get to listen to you guys all the time, and now to see you face to face is awesome. So really appreciate it.
I love it. No, thank you.
Cheers. Thank you.
Cheers.
If you want to share your Home Assistant journey or come on as a guest, reach out to us at feedback@hasspodcast.io. That's hasspodcast.io.
The Home Assistant Podcast is hosted by Phil Hawthorne and myself, Rohan Karamandi. For links to topics we discussed today, check out our show notes on haspodcast.io.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.